Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. My name is Alex Linder and I'm with VNNForum.com, and this is what we call the Learning College. And we're learning the stuff you don't learn in the accredited or government approved schools. Today what we're going to do is chapter 70 of The Unabridged, The International Jew by Henry Ford, appeared in the Dearborn Independent, 1920 and 21. And in recent chapters, we've heard about Jewish control of the liquor industry and the way they debased American distilling, which was an old and honorable tradition. And then we heard about the Jewish army purveyors who more or less pandered to Benedict Arnold and were all associated with him and his downfall. Biggest case of treason in American history, but the Jews are expunged from the record unless you know how to look at it closely. Certainly you won't find out about it in any government school approved textbook. That's what the Learning College is all about, giving you a true white context in which race is left in and isn't falsified. Chapter today is called The Gentle Art of Changing Jewish Names, and this, as I said, is a standalone chapter. It's all about how Jews use front names, front groups. Well, I won't go into front groups, but the principle is the same, that they use cover stories that fool, because apparently our race is gullible enough that it basically a simple thing like changing the appearance takes it in. They don't need to do any more than that to fool most of the gullible goyim as they see us. But anyway, let's get on with chapter 70, The Gentle Art of Changing Jewish Names. The Medansky brothers, Max, Solomon, Benjamin, and Jacob, have written their names henceforth will be May. So changing from Medansky, a typical Eastern European, where the bulk of Jews are from, Russia and Poland, they start pouring in the U.S. after 1880, do things like they anglicize their names to get along better in the new country, the land of milk and honey, as they call America, because they can scam so many people. The Medansky, M-A-D-A-N-S-K-Y, becomes May. It is a good old Anglo-Saxon name, says Ford, but the Medanskys are of Asiatic origin. Elmo Lincoln, a movie actor, comes into a Los Angeles court on the motion of his wife, and it is discovered that he is only Otto Lincolnheld. A large department store owner was born with the name Levy. He is now known as Litton. It is quite possible he did not like the Levy as a name, but why did he not change it to another Jewish name? Or perhaps it was the Jewishness of Levy that displeased him. A popular tenor star recently brought suit against his wife, who married him after allowing him to believe that she was of Spanish origin. Quote, I understood from her misleading stage name that she was Spanish when I married her. Later I found out that she was Jewish and that her real name was Bergenstein. One of the biggest and best-known stores in the United States goes under an honored Christian name, though every one of the owners is Jewish. The public still carries a mental picture of the good old merchant who established the store, which picture would speedily change if the public could get a glimpse of the real owners. Take the name Belmont, for example, and trace its history. Prior to the 19th century, the Jews resident in Germany did not use family names. It was, quote, Joseph, the son of Jacob, Isaac ben Abraham, ben means son, the son being designated as the son of the father. But the Napoleonic era, especially following upon the assembly of the great Sanhedrin under Napoleon's command, he called the council of the leaders of the Jews, caused a distinct change in Jewish customs in Europe. In 1808, Napoleon sent out a decree commanding all Jews to adopt family names. In Austria, a list of surnames was assigned to the Jews, and if a Jew was unable to choose, the state chose for him. The names were devised from precious stones, as Rubinstein, precious metals, such as Goldstein, Silberberg, plants, trees, and animals, such as Mandelbaum, Lilienthal, Oaks, Wolf, and Löwe, of lions, or low, it would be pronounced in English, like the theater chain, but Löwe means lions in German. The German Jews created surnames by the simple method of affixing the syllable son to the father's name, thus making Jacobson, Isaacson, while others adapted the names of the localities in which they lived, the Jew resident in Berlin becoming Berliner, and the Jew resident of Oppenheim becoming Oppenheimer. Now, in the region of Schoenberg, in the German Rhine country, a settlement of Jews had lived for several generations. When the order to adopt surnames went forth, Isaac Simon, the head of the settlement, chose the name of Schoenberg. It signifies in German beautiful hill, Schön, O with the dots over the umlaut, means Schön, S-C-H-O, umlaut, N, Schön means pretty, pretty mountain, or it signifies in German beautiful hill, Berg meaning mountain. It is very easily Frenchified into Belmont, same thing, which also means beautiful hill or mountain. A Columbia University professor once tried to make it appear that the Belmonts originated in the Belmontes family of Portugal, but found it impossible to harmonize this theory with the Schoenberg facts, or Schoenberg, we'll just say. It is noteworthy that a Belmont became American agent of the Rothschilds, or the Rothschilds, and that the name of Rothschild, Red Sign, Schild meaning sign or shield, is derived from the red shield on the house in the Jewish quarter of Frankfurt on the Mine. Mine the river in Frankfurt. Like Stratford on Avon for Shakespeare, Frankfurt on the Mine. What the original family name is has never been divulged. The Jewish habit of changing names is responsible for the immense camouflage that has concealed the true character of Russian events. When Leon Bronstein becomes Leo Trotsky, and when Jewish Apfelbaum, that would be apple tree, becomes the quote-unquote Russian Zinoviev, and when the Jewish Cohen becomes the, quote, Russian Volodarsky, and so on down through the list of controllers of Russia, Goldman becomes Izgoev, and Feldman becoming Vladimirov, it is a little difficult for people who think that names do not lie to see just what is transpiring. Taking the outer appearance for the reality, Goy tend to do, which is why they're so easily fooled. Jews don't. They see a name as a marketing device. Oh, we can take over Russia and be super bloody about it, and we'll just call ourselves by Russian names, and that will fool half the people. That easily, that easy of an artifice, that simple of an artifice fools all these millions of our co-racialists. What kind of a race are we anyway? Bunch of idiots? Indeed, there is any amount of evidence that, in numberless cases, this change of names, or adoption of cover names, as the Jewish description is for purposes of concealment. There is an immense difference in the state of mind in which a customer enters the store of Isidore Levy, or Isidore Levy, and the state of mind in which he enters the store of Alex May. And what would be his feeling to learn that Isidore Levy painted up the name of Alex May with that state of mind in view? When Rosenbluth and Schlesinger becomes, quote, the American Mercantile Company, unquote, there is justification for the feeling that the name American is being used to conceal Jewish character, the Jewish character of the firm. The tendency of Jews to change their names dates very far back. There was and is a superstition that to give a sick person another name is to, quote, change his luck and save him from the misfortune destined upon his old name. There was also the biblical example of a change of nature being followed by a change of name, as when Abram became Abraham and Jacob became Israel. There have been justifiable grounds, however, for Jews changing their names in Europe. The nationalism of that continent is, of course, intense, and the Jews are already an international nation, scattered among all the nations, with an unenviable reputation of being ready to exploit for Jewish purposes the nationalistic intensity of the Gentiles, to mollify a suspicion held against them wherever they have lived, a suspicion so general and so persistent as to be explainable only on the assumption that it was abundantly justified. The Jews have been quick to adopt the names and colors of whatever country they may be living in. It is no trouble at all to change a flag, since none of the flags is the insignia of Judah. This was seen throughout the war zone, World War I. The Jews hoisted whatever flag was expedient at the moment and changed it as often as the shifting tide of battle required. A Polish Jew named Zucker Mandel, Zucker means sugar, emigrating to Hungary, would be anxious to show that he had shuffled off the Polish allegiance, which his name proclaimed, and the only way he could do this would be to change his name, which would very likely become Zukor, a perfectly good Hungarian name. Originally, the Zukor, Z-U-K-O-R, were not Jews. Now the usual guess would be that they are. In the United States, it would be almost a certainty. Such a change as Mr. Zuckermandel would make, however, would not be for the purpose of concealing the fact that he was a Jew, but only to conceal the fact that he was a foreign Jew. In the United States, it has been found that Jews change their names for three reasons. First, for the same reason that many other foreigners change their names, to minimize as much as possible the foreign look and the difficulty of pronunciation which many of those names carry with them. Second, for business reasons, to prevent the knowledge becoming current that so-and-so is a Jew store. And third, for social reasons. The desire not to appear singular among one's neighbors, when stated in just these words, very easily passes muster of being a natural desire until you apply it to yourself. If you were going abroad to Italy, Germany, Russia, there to live and engage in business, would you cast about for a change name immediately? Of course not. Your name is part of you, and you have your own opinion of an alias. The Jew, however, has his own name among his own peoples, regardless of what cover name the world may know him by, and therefore he changes his outside name quite coolly. British in public, Yiddish in private. And again, what in our culture encourages them to believe that we can be fooled by this? Well, history shows we can be fooled. They also know that we have a religion that says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which makes the assumption that you are like everyone else you're likely to meet. But if they are wolves and you are sheep, as your religion, your Christianity, tells you to be, then you're going to be fooled by anyone who takes on the covering of a sheep, by a wolf in sheep's clothing, which is what these front names are. This is why the Germans had, the German nationalists, who were not Western, not Christian, not in keeping with traditional European history, because they saw that tradition was the problem, forced the Jews to wear external visible symbols that they couldn't hide behind, that put what they are on Front Street, as the sassy mamas say. So these Jews were forced to wear yellow golden stars to identify them as Jews so people couldn't be fooled. And that's apparently what it takes, since our people refuse to become intellectual and think about things and read and prefer to be amiable, hail fellow, well met, keep a positive attitude. Everything happens for a reason. So long as we're on that level, we're beneath the level the Jews are at, and we'll continue to be fooled by them. And the German nationalists figured all this stuff out, pretty much uniquely among whites, so far in history. And we are the next to follow up on what they saw, which is that Christianity can't defend the white race. Christianity, rather, protects Jews from whites. It also teaches you not to doubt someone's motives, to take them at face value, to overlook any apparent gap between what they say and what they do. And that cultural conditioning in our people further encourages them not to notice what's going on. Whereas the Jews, by contrast, are all about hidden motives, hidden angles. And this repays greatly to their advantage in business and politics if it makes for a certain nastiness in social intercourse, as we would see it. There's no indication at all that they find it uncomfortable. It's their natural way of being. And if you want to understand this mentality, watch one of the watch the Larry David show. It's probably the best. As they say, that's just unvarnished Seinfeld, showing you the mentality that Jews have and how it's effective. It may be, you can dislike it for whatever reason you want, but when you see this is how this type of person thinks and interacts with other people, always questioning, always wondering what's really going on. Why don't we do that, even to the limited level where it's necessary to defend ourselves? Well, we have to. Otherwise, we will fall prey to these people. This is what is the meaning of this chapter about Jewish names. The front name, the cover name. These are ways they have of tricking others. Whereas, as he says, they have one name among themselves, and they have another name out front for you, for your benefit, meaning to fool you. The only likeness we have to that in America is the changing of men's pay numbers as they move their employment from place to place. John Smith may be number 49 in Black Shop and number 375 in White Shop, but he is always John Smith. So the Jew may be Simon, son of Benjamin, in the privacy of the Jewish circle, while to the world he may be Mortimer Alexander. In the United States, it is hardly to be doubted that business and social reasons are mostly responsible for the changes in Jewish names. The designation American is itself much coveted, as may be gathered from its frequent use in firm names, the members of which are not American in any sense that entitles them to blazon the name throughout the world. And we've heard about this in earlier chapters. They get their American passport or papers or whatever, then they run back over to Russia, presenting themselves as American businessmen. And as he says, they like to use the word American in the titles of their businesses. When Moses is changed to Mortimer, and Nathan to Norton, and Isidore to Irving, as, for example, Irving Berlin, whose relatives, however, still know him as Izzy, the concealment of Jewishness in a country where so much is done by print must be regarded as a probable motive. Again, these are popular Anglo names when the Jews were first coming in, the decades in which the Jews were coming into the U.S. in massive numbers, 1880 to 1924. And so they see, what are the Anglo elite called? And they start renaming their kids that. Murray. Murray Rothbard is an example of that. Llewellyn. As he just said there, there's other ones. Mortimer, right? These old-time Jewish comedians named Mortimer. Nathan to Norton. Mortimer, Norton. Irving, rather than Isidore, Nathan, and Moses. When Mr. Lee Jackson is proposed for the club, there would seem to be no reason, as far as reading goes, why anything unusual about Mr. Jackson should be surmised, until you know that Mr. Jackson is really Mr. Jacobs. Jackson happens to be the name of a president of the United States, which names are quite in favor with the name changers, but in this case, it also happens to be one of the derivatives of an old Jewish name. The Jewish Encyclopedia contains interesting information on this matter of derivatives. Asher is shaded off into Archer, Ansel, and Asherson. Baruch is touched up into Benedict, Benetton, Bertold. Benjamin becomes Lopez, Seif, Wolf. This is translation. David becomes Davis, Davison, Davies, Davidson. Benjamin becomes Lopez, Seif. Oh, that was already repeated. Let's see. Isaac becomes Sax, Saxa, Sace, Sekel. Jacob becomes Jackson, Jacoby, Jacobus, Jacob, Kaplan, Kaufman, Marchant, Merchant. Jonah becomes, by quite simple changes, Jones and Joseph, Jonas. Judah, the true Jewish name, becomes Jewel, Leo, Leon, Lionel, Lion, Leone, Judith. Levi becomes Leopold, Levin, or Levine, Lewis, Leva, Lo, Lowy. Moses becomes Moritz, Moss, Mortimer, Max, Mac, Maskin, Masi. Solomon becomes Salmon, Salome, Sloman, Salmoth. And so on through the list of Jewish changelings. Barnett, Barnard, Beer, Herschel, Mann, Mendel, Mandel, Mendelssohn, with various others which are not even adaptations, but sheer appropriations. The millinery business, which is one of the principal Jewish grafts off American women, shows the liking of the Jews for names which do not name, but which stand as impressive insignia. Lucille, Mademoiselle Grand, and the like. Reuben Abraham Cohen is a perfectly good name, and a good citizen could make it immensely respected in his neighborhood, but Reuben thinks that the first round in the battle of mine should be his, and he does not scruple at a little deceit to obtain it, so he painted on a window of his store, R.A. Lacan, which when set off with a borrowed coat of arms, looks sufficiently Frenchified for even observant boobs among the Gentiles. Similarly, a Mr. Barondesky may blossom out as Barondess or La Baron. Commonly, Mr. Abraham becomes Mr. Miller. Why Miller should have been picked on for Judaization is not clear, but the Millers of the white race may yet be compelled to adopt some method of indicating that their name is not Jewish. It is conceivable that a Yiddish and an American form of the same name may sometime be deemed necessary. Aarons becomes Arnold. There are a number of Jewish Arnolds, like Tom Arnold. Aarons becomes Allingham. One Cohen became Druce, D-R-U-C-E. Another Cohen became Freeman, F-R-E-E-M-A-N. Still another Cohen became a Montague, like Ashley Montague, wrote bullshit race books in the middle part of the 20th century. A fourth Cohen became a Rothbury, and a fifth Cohen became a Cook. The Cohens have an excuse, however. In one ghetto, there are so many Cohens that some distinction must be observed. There is Cohen the Rag Gatherer, and Cohen the Sachet, ritual meat killer, and Cohen the Rising Lawyer, as well as Cohen the Physician. To make the matter more difficult, their first names, otherwise their Christian names, are Lewis. It is not to be wondered at, therefore, that the young lawyer should become Attorney Cohane, which does all the better if thereby certain Irish clients are attracted, as in George M. Cohan, who's an Irish guy. It's a grand old flag in the stage dancing. You've probably seen the video. That's an Irish name. It's very similar, obviously, to Cohen, which is one of the main rabbinical names. And that the young doctor should become Dr. Khan or Cohn. These are some of the many forms that the priestly name of Cohen takes. Example, Sally Cohn has written extremely anti-white stuff. I forget who she writes for. You see her stuff online, Twittered out. Very, very anti-white columns. So Khan and Cohn are variations of Cohen, which is one of the priestly classes of Jews, the Jewiest of Jews. The same may be said with reference to Kaplan, a very common name. Charlie Chaplin's name was, in all probability, Kaplan or Kaplan. At any rate, this is what the Jews believe about their great star. Non-Jews have read of Charlie as a, quote, poor English boy. There is the Reverend Stephen S. Wise for another example. He booms his way across the country from one platform to another, a wonder in his way, sort of the Alan Dershowitz of his time, that such pomposity of sound should convey such paucity of sense. He is an actor, the less effective because he essays a part in which sincerity is requisite. This rabbi, whose vocal exercise exhausts his other powers, was born in Hungary, his family name being Wise, W-E-I-S-Z. Sometimes this name is Germanized to Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, means white in German. When S.S. Wise became S.S. Wise, we do not know. If he had merely Americanized his Hungarian name, that's the S.Z. formulation is the Hungarian, like Zabor, it would have given him the name White in English. Apparently Wise looked better, so he went from Hungarian to German when he came to America. Truly it is better to be white than to be Wise. But Dr. Stephen S. is a fresh point of query of what's in a name. The list of Jews in public life whose names are not Jewish would be a long one. Lewis Marshall, head of the American Jewish Committee, for example, what could his old family name have been before it was changed for the name of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States? Mr. Selwyn's name, now so widely known in motion pictures, was originally Schlesinger. Some of the Schlesingers became Sinclairs, but Selwyn made a really good choice for a man in the show business. A rabbi whose real name was Poznansky became Posner, famous law guy, legal writer today, Gerald Posner, remember that. Name Kalin is usually an abbreviation of Kalensky. Remember Horace Kalin, who inventor of multiculturalism as the concept around 1900, is an example of that name. A true story is told of an East Side tinsmith whose name was very decidedly foreign Jewish. It is withheld here because the Dearborn Independent prefers, in this connection, to mention only the names of those who can take care of themselves. But the tinsmith moved to a non-Jewish section and opened a new shop under the name of Perkins, and his luck really did change. He is doing well, and being an industrious, honest workman deserves his prosperity. Of course, there are lower uses of name-changing practice, as every employee of labor knows. A man contracts a debt under one name, and to avoid a garnishee, quits his job, collects his pay, and in a day or two attempts to hire out under another name. This was once quite a successful trick, and is not wholly unknown now. There is also much complaint among the stricter observers of the Jewish ritual requirements that the word kosher is greatly misused, that indeed it covers a multitude of sins. Kosher has come to signify, in some places, little more than a commercial advertisement designed to attract Jewish trade. For all it means, of course, what it says, it might just as well be, quote, the best place in town to eat, which it isn't, of course, and neither is it always, quote, strictly, unquote, kosher. It must be conceded, however, that the tendency to mislabel men and things is deep set in Jewish character. That's a very memorable line. The tendency to mislabel men and things is deep set in Jewish character. Jews are great coiners of catchwords that are not true, inventors of slogans that do not move. There is a considerable decrease in the power they wielded by such methods. Their brilliancy in this respect is running to seed. This may be explained by the fact that there are so many song titles to write for the Jewish jazz factories and so much snappy matter for screen descriptions. Their comeback is painfully thin and forced. Without peers in dealing with a superficial situation like a dispute over the beauty of two rival stars or the amount and method of distributing confetti, they are the veriest dubs in dealing with a situation like that which has arisen in this country. Immediately upon the appearance of the Jewish question in the United States, the Jews reverted naturally to their habit of mislabeling. They were going to fool the people once more with a pat phrase. They are still seeking for that phrase. Slowly they are recognizing that they are up against the truth, and truth is neither a jazzy jade nor a movie motto which can be recostumed and changed at will. Of course, this is right before they invent racism, the best smear ever. This passion for misleading people by names is deep and varied in its expression. Misleading people by names. I'm going to repeat that. This passion for misleading people by names is deep and varied in its expression. Chiefly due to Jewish influences, we are given the name of liberalism to looseness. We are dignifying with names that do not correctly name many subversive movements. We are living in an era of false labels whose danger is recognized by all who observe the various underground currents which move through all sections of society. Socialism itself is no longer what its name signifies. The name has been seized and used to label anarchy. Judaistic influence creeping into the Christian church has kept the apostolic labels but thoroughly destroyed the apostolic content. The disruptive work has gone on quietly and unhindered because often as the people looked, the same label was there, and as the same old merchant's name stays in the store the Jews have bought and cheapened. Thus there are reverends who are both unreverend and irreverent, and there are shepherds who flock with the wolves. Zionism is another misnomer. Modern Zionism is not what its label would indicate it to be. The managers of the new money collection, millions of it, badly used, badly accounted for, are about as much interested in Zionism as an Ohio Baptist is in Meccaism, Meccaism, Islam. For the leading so-called Zionist, Mount Zion and all that it stands for has next to no meaning. They see only the political and real estate aspects of Palestine, another people's country, just at present. The present movement is not religious, although it plays upon the religious sentiments of the lower class of Jews. It is certainly not what the Judaized orators among the Christians want the Christians to think it is. Zionism is at present a most mischievous thing, potentially a most dangerous thing, as several governments could confidentially tell you. Again, this is 28 years before Israel is established, and the Jews are starting to move in there, buy up property, and harass the natives, the locals. But it is all a part of the Jewish practice of setting up a label pretending one thing, while quite another thing really exists. Take anti-Semitism. That is a label which the Jews have industriously pasted up everywhere. If ever it was an effective label, its uses are over now. So again, we see, oh, the racism is losing its power. Even back 100 years ago, from when I'm telling you this, people were claiming that racism, or which wasn't that then yet invented, but the terms that were invented, anti-Semitism, which had been invented maybe 40 years earlier, around 1880 or 1880s, they're saying, oh, it's losing its power. It doesn't no longer means anything. See, they've been wrong consistently. So keep that in mind. He's underrating the power of the Jews. He's underrating the depth and coherence and ability. He's overrating the ability to fight back against it, because he's saying, oh, it just needs to be exposed, or, oh, its power is waning. No, in fact, he's saying its power is waning, when in fact its power was growing, waxing, not waning. If ever it was an effective label, its uses are now over, says Ford in 1921. Well, now, as I read you, it's 2016, 95 years later. Anti-Semitism is still a powerful charge that people flee from, scared. It's more powerful now than it was then. It doesn't mean anything. Well, it never has meant anything. Anti-Semitism, as the woman says, would record on a video that we have 100 years later. It's a trick that we always play, she says. Anti-Semitism does not exist, since the thing so named is found among the Semites, too. Semites cannot be anti-Semitic. When the world holds up a warning finger against a race that is the moving spirit of the corruptive, subversive, and destructive influences abroad in the world today, that race cannot nullify the warning by sticking up a false label of anti-Semitism any more than it can justify a sign of gold on a 150 watch or on the sign of pure wool on an 1150 suit of clothes. So with the whole group of labels which the Jews have trotted out like talisman to work some magic spell upon the aroused mind of America, they are lies, and when one lie falls, how quickly they hitch their hopes to another. If anti-Semitism fails, then try anti-Catholic. That might do something. If that fails, try anti-American. Get the biggest talent that could be hired for a night on the B'nai B'rith platform to shout it. And when that fails, as it has, question mark. So they'll run from one to another. The American Jewish Committee itself is a misnomer. The committee is not exclusively American, and its work is not to Americanize the Jews, nor even to encourage real Americanization among them. It is a committee composed of Jews representing that class which profits by most by keeping the mass of the Jews segregated from Americans and in bondage to the higher-ups among the Jews. They are the big Jews, as Norman Hapgood used to call them, who say to the little Jews, "You hang closely together. We will be your representatives to these foreign peoples, the Americans and others." If the American Jewish Committee would change its name to this, the Jewish Commission for America, it might be nearer the truth. It has dealt with America in the recent past very much as the Allied Commissions deal with Germany. There are certain things we may do, and certain things we may not do, and the Jewish Commission for America tells us what we may do and what we may not do. One of the things we may not do is to declare that this is a Christian country. There is one absolutely safe rule in dealing with anything emanating from the American Jewish Committee. Don't rely on the label. Open the matter up. You will find that the Kehillah is not what it pretends to be, that the Jewish Labor Union is not what it pretends to be, that Zionism is a camouflage for something entirely different, that the name and the nature are nearly always different, which is the reason for a particular name being chosen. It runs all the way through Jewish practice and presents another little job for the Jewish reformer. And that would be the end of chapter 70. That was printed in the 12th of November, 1921, so that everything Jews do proceeds under a fake name, essentially, is what he's saying, usually to convey the opposite, a style, taste, and quality, when in fact it's shoddy Jewish merchandise, and the Zelensky parts and the Callahan box, the revolution within the form, the take me at my face value, you stupid goyim, let me fool you. And that's not just in their personal names, but in the names of all of their associations, like the American Jewish Committee and their labor unions, etc. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.